people who engage with magic carry various labels. Players, collectors, enthusiasts. But another label that's almost inescapably true is customer. Magic the Gathering is, after all, a commercial product, and so it could be argued that everything that goes towards the game creatively, be it game mechanics or art, is in part done so to better sell the game. Can the game's art be separated from its commercial origin, and does it even matter if it can't? We talked to one of Magic's most prolific New School artists, Titus Lunter, about his outlook on the validity of fantasy art and where his own balances lie as both a player and an artist. Welcome to Magic the Flavoring, the Magic the Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things magic flavor, design, and lore. I'm your host, Andy Mam.
Hello, this is Nathan Cancel.
And today on the show, we have a very special guest. We have artist extraordinaire Titus Lunter. Hello, Titus. How are you doing?
Hey, everyone. I'm all right. How are you guys?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad at all. It's been really hot in the UK recently. Like, we're in London, the both of us, or Nathan, you're now just south of London, and It's been sweltering. How are things in the Netherlands, like, weather-wise?
Warm.
Warm, yeah,
warm.
The weather's too close.
We had the proud number three position of warmest weather here last summer with a sweltering 43. So I'm really hoping we can avoid that this year because the paint is literally melting off of the asphalt. So that's no fun.
Okay, I feel put in our place now, Nathan, because it's hit like 32 and we've been sat here whinging. 43, that's a bit much.
Well, it got to like 36, I think, on Friday, and I went my normal colour from white to pink. British summer had hit by that point. I could recognise it. So
we just don't do air conditioning here in Europe.
We don't, I know.
It's not a thing.
I saw a lot of discourse on Twitter, and I think I actually said this a couple of months ago when it was also hot, where there was a lot of people stateside being like, why is everyone in Europe complaining? Don't you have AC? It's like, no, we don't have AC. We have a window and a hand fan. That's all we have, like, between us. Like, there's no air, there's no nothing.
Yeah, it's like celery. Like, the more you fan, the hotter you get. So it's really just, like, perpetuating itself. Also, this is, like, I think, the third time we've started an interview with a conversation about the weather. We are typically unbelievably British, Andy, man.
Well, the last time we spoke about it was with Wayne Reynolds, who is a fellow Englishman, so it kind of came naturally. I think maybe Titus might be looking at us like we're nuts, but there we are. Titus, I got you on the show. I approached you on Twitter, in fact, last week, because the Theros Beyond Death D&D book just released last week. It released on the 21st of July, and you have artwork in it, right? You did a lot of the artwork. And in fact, I think the piece that you were showing off was your piece for Kuranos, God of Storms. You did a few pieces for that.
Yeah, for the Theros book, I didn't do a lot. I was on a break from Magic art when Theros got commissioned, so I kind of missed the boat in that one. And it bummed me out a little bit that I didn't get to illustrate anything for Theros because I like the plane. I think it's cool. They have a lot of cool stuff in there. So I was talking to one of the art directors over on D&D, and they just happened to mention that, you know, they were working on the Theros D&D book, a little crossover. I was like, oh, that's cool. And I managed to haggle a piece from them for the book. So at least I got to work on Theros a little bit. It was just the one for that one. But Theros kind of lightning bolting a boat was, it was fun.
It was really cool. And I think the thing which I reached out to you about, because you are a known magic artist that is also heavily invested in the gaming side of it. Like, you've been playing for a long time. I think I've heard you in other interviews say you've been playing consistently since around 2010, 2011.
It's
kind of played a little bit earlier. And I was interested to know, doing artwork from a game that you play, so Magic the Gathering artwork, but doing it in the medium of Dungeons and Dragons, which isn't a million light years removed. It's still Wizards of the Coast. But like, the differences between that. And I think you were saying that actually it is quite different, because the D&D is like high fantasy, which is something that's quite different for you. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I mean, I came from a science fiction kind of background, right, and stuff that I like to do. And then realism, because of the concept art, the pre-visualization art for video games. So I kind of, that got me into magic, because for the first that I did, Khans of Tarkir, they happen to need really realistic lands, right? Because Tarkir is one of the more realistic down-to-earth planes that we have compared to some of the crazier ones.
Sure.
So when I transitioned to some D&D stuff, it was much more high fantasy. Their approach to cameras and their approach to what they want to show in an image, kind of the narrative that they want to tell, is way different because it's disconnected from mechanics, right? It's not linked to this fills the, you know, 2/2 flyer spot, or this fills the creature removal spot. So they have a different approach, and as such, they want different things from the image. So yeah, that's a little, it takes a little getting used to for me, but it's fun. It mixes things up a little, even though I'm pretty much illustrating the same thing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's an interesting one because you've done about 88 commissions for Magic at this time. I think it's about 88. And you are someone that has quite a healthy mixture of landscapes and creature cards, or, you know, permanents which have like figures on them, characters. And it was kind of interesting to see you doing this god figure for D&D, which from me just looking as like a fan of your work, seemed to have the perspective of one of your landscapes with the character in the middle. It was kind of a nice mashup to see. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Are you playing Magic at the moment? Like you've been playing Magic for a while. Have you managed to play much Magic recently during all these pandemic times?
Not too. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, I tried to do it like through whatever I can, so Tabletop Simulator, you know, just to get in any kind of game in.
Scratch the
itch. I haven't really touched Magic Arena. Yeah, exactly. Scratch the itch. So no, I hope to. I like the in-game, or the in-person games a lot better. I mean, it's sure. You know, because you're also there for the social interaction, of course. And I'm not a very competitive player. So, you know, going on Arena to grind out games, or that's not really my jam. But yeah, no, a little pickup games in Tabletop Simulator with my play group. Yeah.
What formats do you tend to play at the moment?
Well, now it's mostly EDH.
That's the one. Correct.
Such a leading question.
Yeah, I want to know, is he going to talk about Standard and we're just going to have to nod quietly for a while?
No, I haven't touched Standard in a long time. No, it used to be Modern. It used to be Limited and Modern, and then moved to EDH when I got less competitive, kind of less sweaty, you know.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, a little less on the line, other than your creative pride, I think. What's your kind of hotness at the moment? What's your favorite commander that you're playing in your arsenal, if you have one?
Well, I built a community deck with the help of the community not too long ago. It was it started out as a really kind of like stupid project, I guess. I wanted to be, you know, talking a lot about positivity. That's one of the things that I enjoy a lot, you know, bringing positivity to the community, onboarding players, showing them, you know, maybe a different side to the game that you, you know, maybe don't get when you watch just the, you know, the streams online. So I thought, I'll build a deck completely surrounding the theme, you win the game, cards that say you win the game. And I took a few combos out that were, you know, because then if you add the combos, it gets too sweaty, and then it's not really you win the game. It's more like you're super hard trying to win the game, which is sort of defeating the point. So I built this five color Golos deck, Proliferate, Helix Pinnacle, kind of shenanigans, all that kind of stuff. And I tested it out, and it worked pretty well. So I thought, all right, tweak this, and then it started working just really, really well. So I've kind of been on a binge of my five color Golos, you win the game deck. I don't think it's very fun to play against because it's pretty much it's a lock.
With Golos, no way, but, it's not fun to play against. Surely not.
Okay, I don't abuse him a lot, but it, you know, it was either Golos or, you know, Progenitus or whatever five color. Yeah. But yeah, just for the five colors. But Golos is useful.
Golos is very useful. Do you tend to find, like, I mean, the one of the big things that I'm basically always going to be slightly leading towards in this chat is, like, when you're building decks, when you're playing, does your artist brain working on Magic the Gathering and having worked on Magic the Gathering for a few years cross over with your player brain? Like, is it in the style that you play or the cards that you choose? Like, say if you're building a deck, does your artistic eye take over, or can you keep those things fairly separate?
No, I'm very picky about my lands. Like,
oh yeah,
damn right, sure. Yes,
yeah. Run off to my own heart, fantastic. What
that takes me the longest.
Like, so all right, let's say your Golos deck is an example. Then, like, how have you? What were the lands in your Golos deck? How did you formulate those?
So here I run into one of my big issues with lands, which is which set of original Ravnica duels do I pick? Right? Do I pick the ones from Guild Pact, or do I pick the one from Return? Because the Steam Vents from Return is arguably for me the best Steam Vents art wise. But then I do like the old school Rob Alexander Guild Pact Temple Garden. But the Steam Vents of guilds and the old temper, they don't really mix very well. So it's like, what do I do? These are the stupid things that take me the longest in trying to build a deck. And the rest is kind of like whatever.
Not stupid at all. I've got a Bruderclad deck where all the lands are from Urza's Saga and the islands have the lightning motif, which are some of the only islands to have them. And I had to have the command tower from the Brawl precons because they had the lightning tower aesthetic then. So no, you're not stupid at all. You are bang on the money. This is what you should be thinking about. You're building tech.
For me, it's for the little thing. Sometimes different printings of lands have slightly different saturations as well in the boxes. So it's not even a matter of, if you could get away with ignoring the set symbol, like realistically next to each other, they do just look too different, which is an unfortunate thing between years as you go through. But I'm slowly converting all of my basic lands to pre-new border. And it's quite a hefty achievement to do when you've got 17 decks to do. But it's really nice. Sure. It makes you really look like the planes from the one with the lightning. Talking about lightning motif, the lightning planes is to this day, I think, still my favorite artwork from a planes ever. And I completely forgotten about it until I went back through the collection. So, lands really do pick up a lot.
Yeah, sometimes you just find a land and you kind of like it. Like, first off, I was kind of miffed about the fact that when my Hour of Devastation full art planes came back, it was basically just black. Which is obviously I didn't paint a black image, but that was just the printing. But then I've been on like a mission trying to find the right planes, and I found the planes that I really like. But it's an MPS series planes by John Avon for Mirrodin from 2011. And there's the printing that looks best is the Japanese version. And I'm not being like like a land snob. It's just that I got the card in my hand and was like, oh shit, this is like the best planes I've ever seen. What is it? It's mirrored in, but I don't recognize it. Oh, it's an MPS series. What's MPS series? Oh, it's Japanese. And then like the card is, for a basic, it's pretty expensive. It's like $2. But nobody has it. You know, try finding 40 of a planes that literally nobody has. I'm like, that's I don't want to. Just either somebody sell me 40 or I'm not going to bother.
I had a similar thing when I wanted, again, it was actually a John Avon land as well, similarly, for my monocolor red deck. I wanted the Sunset Mountain John Avon artwork, and the only ones I could find were ones from the World Championship replica decks, where they gold border them. So I ordered 30 from two different sellers. I managed to get 15 from one, 15 from another, and they came, and it's the old frame with a gold border and the John Avon Sunset Mountain. And actually... Mm. To be a land snob, I think some lands look better with that gold border on the card. So yeah, I think you definitely need to shop around. Have you done a Titus Lunter land deck? Because you should have at this point. I think you've got all the basics covered, haven't you?
You've got the snows as well.
Yeah, like not to be particular, but like a few minutes ago, you said I had 88 cards. I think I have 88 lands. I think my card count is, with the commissions I'm doing now, it's probably 150.
Oh wow, okay, I've miscounted. That's a lot.
So it's like I'm having this useless chase for Kev Walker and the guys are up in the 400s, but I guess if the game sticks around for a little longer, who knows. No, I mean, sometimes I have my own lands and my own decks. I don't want to default do it. Usually I do because I have the artist proofs and it's just easy to have them, lying around. But it's kind of weird. You show up to a play group and you go like, hey, I'm Titus and I play with my own lands. Like, I don't know.
It depends on how you say it. If you deliver it like that, I think I'm like, yeah, all right, Titus, I bet.
I absolutely would. No, I wouldn't judge you at all. I'd be a little bit upset if you didn't have a deck with all your own lands and most of your own creatures and stuff like that. I think that's one of the best things about working on a game like this, surely.
Most of all my own creature. Yeah.
for better or for worse.
Yeah.
So other than your sort of interest in getting the right lands, what other flavor things across Magic kind of catch your eye? Do you have any like tribes or a certain plane that really get your juices going?
I'm a big fan of Mirrodin. I used to, when I played Modern, it was all artifact stuff. So any plane that revolves around artifacts quite heavily, except for Kaladesh, and not because anything against Kaladesh, but just because from an illustration point of view, illustrating that plane is such a gigantic headache that if we never go back there, it's, you know, it's still too soon.
too much filigree. Too
it's
much
too
filigree.
Much filigree. It is, yeah.
It's crazy. Forever.
But tribes wise, no, I guess I'm a bit of a Timmy player. So any big creatures will do. And then anything that kind of combos off. So I guess I haven't really, you know, gotten rid of that sweaty competitive side because Jorah EDH decks, like new school Jorah EDH decks with combos, mixing it up a little bit with the Aether Flux.
Reservoir. But,
Reservoir. Yeah. And that's mostly because I, you know, like artifacts. So it's like, oh, there's an artifact deck. And then if you build a good artifact deck, it's good, right? A good creature deck can be a little mediocre.
You're talking to a brain player here. I get you. I'm all over that.
Yeah. Frankly, I think you two are scum, but yeah, that's absolutely fine.
you play a Brudaclad deck, for God's sake.
I play a Brudaclad tokens deck. I hit people in the face with a bunch of tokens.
Sure. I'm not
being against you. Pot kettle black. That's fine.
I mean, like, we're definitely going back to New Phyrexia in the next sort of year, right? Like, so I mean, it's got to be on the horizon. I won't put you on the spot, Tyce. If you do have commissions that you can't talk about, don't worry about it. Right, but like, we've been saying for months that we think we're going to go back there. In fact, we had the Wayne Reynolds Blightsteel Colossus full art, right? Like, what do you think of that? Because that artwork was so, if you took the Chris Rann Blightsteel versus the Wayne Reynolds Blightsteel, and Wayne Reynolds has injected all this color and movement into these kind of big constructs, like, do you dig it, or are you a bit more old school with your kind of constructs?
Well, I mean, Wayne is pretty old school. He's been around forever. And talking about, you know, iconic art, I think not a lot of artists have the privilege of being able to be around long enough and be iconic enough that they have their own style, right? If you see something Wayne Reynolds, it is Wayne Reynolds. So you can clearly see the derivatives of, right? He inspired almost an entire generation of fantasy art. Mm. So, but I think, yeah, I don't know. I think I like the diversity of having both pieces there. I'm a bit of a Chris Rann fanboy as well, but I mean I know him quite well, so seeing the kind of moody desaturated pieces, they really appeal to me. But then if it depends on the deck where it goes in, right? If I had my five color Golas deck that's quite colorful, and I'd have to include one of those, I'd include the Wayne Reynolds one because it's, you know, nice and colorful. So it kind of depends, but that's the beauty of having alternate art versions.
Yeah, right.
For every deck is a new sword. Yeah,
exactly. Which one fits better? And the fact you can choose between a nuance of different art styles and different art like it. But don't get me wrong, I'm really annoyed they've done another selection of swords, because it's, as much as they do get a little bit cheaper, it's just another selection of cards I can't get my hands on without it costing me half a mortgage. But yeah, no, it's really great that you can obviously choose between, if you want to have a nice moody, like dark metalwork kind of deck, or if you wanted to have, you know, a more light, upbeat, you know, Goblin Tinkerer deck, then obviously, yeah, those two things do satisfy the theme of the deck a little bit better.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. So when you're building them, when you're playing, should I say, do you tend to find that the players around you, the kind of play group that you're in, also have this appreciation for the art side of things? Or do you think that this kind of interest, which is peaking at the moment and is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but do you think that's still kind of fairly niche? Or do you think it's something we could see in the very near future becoming like a majority idea of the game, as being this vessel for artwork, as opposed to just a game that happens to have artwork on it? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, in my play group, it's a bit of a hit and miss. I mean, some of the guys have no idea when even one of the artwork is mine, right? They just don't care. Regardless who does it, right? Like even if the person who did the artwork is sitting right across them, they would not know and they would not really care. And others, they do care more, because, you know, when you're playing and you're having these conversations, you know about an Easter egg in a card, or you see something that's technically incredibly difficult, but it doesn't look it, you know, you talk about it, you point it out, and you engage them a little bit more, and it grows. And I think, especially in the early days, people have such a nostalgia for the artwork from 20, 25 years ago. But even then, the artwork wasn't really talked about that much. It seems like the appreciation for artwork always comes in hindsight, and it's unmistakably linked to how good the card is or how much impact it had on the person themselves from a Delphic card.
Rarity as well, whether it was a common or a mythic or things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a shame.
I mean, that's something we spoke about with our very first ever interview. We had Vorthos Mike on, and he was talking about how you can find some of the best art is at the front of the booster pack, and how people kind of miss it if they just shuffle through back to the rare or to the mythic rare at the back of the booster. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. WotC have just released that they're going to be doing these things called set boosters, right? Which is a new kind of booster pack, which is geared more towards people who just like cracking packs for fun. And in those, they're bringing back the art cards, which were in Modern Horizons, which is literally, I mean, as a player, if you were just looking just generally, like, that's all I care about, I just want to get the mechanics, those are pretty much wasted bits of cardboard in a booster pack. But as someone who appreciates the artwork, like, that's pretty cool, right? Like, they're actually including literal artwork in the booster pack as you go. Like, do you think that's a good step forwards, or is it a bit kind of wishy-washy, like, from someone who is an artist?
No, I think it's a great idea. I think WotC has maintained that art is one of their core pillars of the business, and you can see it because, you know, it's literally everywhere. They make no secret of it that art is incredibly important to them. But it's always kind of difficult to market, because you can't play the game simply because of the art, because the game revolves around mechanics, right? They say that's the other core pillar. It's you're a planeswalker. You play a planeswalker who is going to destroy your opponent. Mm. I think the original line was destroy your opponent with creatures, but that's no longer true. So, but art was a very important aspect of that to get people involved in the lore, to get people involved in the game, kind of like that immersion, right? And they have marketed the competitive side a lot, and I think it's good that they now also market the art side quite a bit. So you kind of get that state of equilibrium a little bit more, right? Where it's, yes, it is a competitive game, and if you want to play it competitively, there's a place for that. But if you don't play competitively and you're kind of scared that the game is only about that competitive side, here's also this, you know, hand reaching out that it says, no, you can also appreciate it for the art. And there's actually a lot of people who do appreciate it for the art. And here's a bit more of a casual side where it's about the social experience. And I think art plays a pretty important role in connecting new players to the social experience, rather than the competitive side allows them to do that.
Like I said, I think having these little art cards is a great transition way for people that don't pay attention to the artwork necessarily when they look at the card, because they look at the power and toughness, they look at the rarity, they look at what the card does, you know, they look at the name. And when you put these, and this happened a couple of times with the Modern Horizons, I got to the end of the pack and I looked at it and I went, oh, I didn't realize that the art. And then I went back and looked at the other card and went, oh God, yeah, this looks so much. And that difference in size from the box frame that you normally get for the art and then actually a full art version of it on the card highlights so much more. And I think it does, as you say, like it gives players a chance to kind of stop and think and look at them. And as you say, if you've got cards, you know, like Cosmotronic Wave that sit at the back of the pack and no one gives a crap about, I'm sorry, if I could get Cosmotronic Wave as a giant print all over my wallpaper, I would. you know, so it's one of those things of, yeah, if this is a really good way to make them. And again, if they're going to theme the packs to be like, say, a fiery pack or a dragony kind of pack, then it gives them a chance to highlight what they think is maybe the best dragon artwork of the set or whatever, you know. And I think, it does, as you say, back tie it altogether a little bit better, because I don't think half the people, especially when they're new to the game, as much as they do have their favorite looking creature and everything, they probably won't pay attention beyond, you know, the first few cards, because their eyes probably get a bit bored and dull of, you know, looking at 15 artworks every pack.
That's true. I think the art though is connected to the mechanics though, isn't it? Like something we spoke about with Ant Tessitore a few weeks ago when he was on talking about the different functions of different bits on the card, like the name, the flavor text, the mechanics and the artwork, is that the artwork is a tool to kind of get people to understand the game better if it's a good connection between the artwork and the mechanics.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. Like, as someone, again, like to kind of tie it back to your experience as a player, Titus, like as someone who is both a player and an artist for the game, if you were to take your artist side of things now, does your player brain encroach on your artist brain when you're doing art for the game? Like, do you see the mechanics as you're painting, or do you try and take it completely divorced from what's going to be on the card?
Well, we don't know what the mechanics will be. We don't know what the power and toughness will be. But sometimes in the wording of the brief, you know, outside of it being a land, you can kind of get a feel for what the card is going to do. So when I painted the Sphinx of Foresight, right, you see blue, you see Sphinx, you go like, okay, these are traditionally card draw, scry, extra turns kind of things. And they're quite serious. They have quite a big impact on the game. So you want to you immediately think that, okay, I'm going to try and do something that's a little bit more iconic and striking and easy to read, that has a striking silhouette, because if it does turn out to be a very important card, you want that card to be easily recognizable from across the table. When somebody puts it down and it is an important card and it has an important trigger or ETB or whatever, then you want that to be clear, right? That will help sell the game. Same for, you said Cosmotronic Wave earlier, that's a removal spell. You know, they go like, yeah, this is a green or a red spell. You go like, this instant or sorcery. That clearly has a destruction thing, an overflowing thing. So you go like, okay, might be a removal spell. It's they clearly specified that it's an Izzet mage and the power was overflowing. So you go like, maybe this could be in a braid type situation, or, you know, one of the other cards that it did was damage or artifact removal. So you go like, okay, yeah, I need to show that this thing could break stuff, right? So maybe you'll put some extra destruction in the ground that we can clearly see, yeah, this stuff, you know, can break.
That's interesting, because you might end up then second guessing yourself, being like, because then you might overthink, being like, okay, right, so exactly what card is this going to be? And, you know, exactly, that's quite
interesting. For sure. Yeah.
Oh yeah, maybe your player brain actually gets in the way a little bit, because you're always trying to second guess. What about cards that are, that you know for sure what the card's going to be? And what I mean by that is, you recently did the judge promo for Birthing Pod.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
right. Did they give you the name Birthing Pod? Did they tell you that's what it was going to be?
Yeah.
How do you approach that? How does that change things for you?
That's a complicated question.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot there. Yeah. Tell me everything about how you work.
it's fine, because it's complicated, because it's a layered question, right? Mm. I had the fortune of getting to do quite a few reprints, from Wrath of God to Ensnaring Bridge. You know, these are no small card. So when you see that come in, you kind of like pause for a second, because you don't want to mess up, right? That's the first thing. You really don't want to mess up. And you don't want to mess up because of the players or whatever, because not everybody's going to like your artwork. So you kind of have to drop that immediately. Mm-hmm. But there is quite the heritage. So when you're doing a reprint, you're always fighting nostalgia. That's the thing. You're fighting nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And as a player, you want to make sure that you give the appropriate nod. Because I think if you have the understanding of how the game works, and this is by no means a requirement for everybody who wants to do Magic art, but should you be in the position where you do understand where the card is coming from, if it's a reprint, then I think it becomes kind of fun to try and figure out, where is that nostalgia coming from? What exactly is it in people that makes them like that card, that makes them like that old artwork, and how do you then approach the reprint, right? So in this case, the brief was pretty clear. They said, you know, if it's a reprint, it's always in the name. So this was Birthing Pod, and I knew it was going to be the Birthing Pod. And they had a Phyrexian creature coming out of a pod or egg. And that was something that I could design myself, right? So then you start to think, okay, where do I want this to be? Phyrexia, Mirrodin, that's kind of cool. That's kind of like that cycle of rebirth, so we're going to do it there. What kind of creature do we want it to be? Well, I have a deep and profound love for the Phyrexian Obliterator. I think I mentioned that about a thousand times now, as seen as the new Phyrexian Swamp that I did, which has the Obliterator on there.
Well, I think, I spoke to you not too long ago about your swamp on Twitter, and how you chose for it to be an Obliterator, and you also pitched it being the Vault of Whispers in the background, which was the kind of dilapidated structure, right?
Yeah. So, but when you get that kind of thing, it you know, a lot of gears start turning, like, how do you want to do it and how do you want. And I think one of the original things is that Birthing Pod is a really controversial card, because some people will cheer and some people will sigh their deepest sigh when that thing hits the battlefield.
Yeah, it's like a Kiki or anything else. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, divisive.
It's a Marmite card. Yeah.
Very divisive. Yeah, it is a Marmite card. So, you know, you approach that in a way where you go like, okay, this needs to be more visually striking than normal. I need to pay more homages to all these little things, right? So the egg where it comes out of has lotus petals. And the altar that it stands on is from an old, I think, Rob Alexander Plains. It was a corrupted Mirrodin structure. So you try to layer in all these things because I think subconsciously people will recognize it, right? Not everybody knows exactly what, you know, the Vault of Whispers looks like or what that one specific Plains from Mirrodin from, you know, whichever artist looks like. But they've seen it. They've seen it hundreds of times, even though they may not realize it. So when you layer that stuff in there, you're kind of playing, you're playing into that. You're paying homage to what is done before. You're playing into what people maybe expect to see, what they'd like to see, and you're tying it into something resonates. That you find interesting. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But it goes through a lot of iterations and steps. So it's kind of complicated painting pieces like that.
Did you deliberately go for a kind of aliens look? Because it kind of reminded me a little bit.
Yeah, good.
Because I'm looking, I'm like, that is a face hugger pod if ever I've seen.
No, I mean, Alien is my top five. It's in my top five or maybe top three.
I can see why Phyrexian Obliterator is as well then, because those two are fairly synonymous. Yeah.
Well, I think all those, actually it's funny that you say that, you've just dropped in that that's your favorite film, because I think that explains so much about how you approach your artwork then, especially for things like Lands. Like, I think we did a Cracker Pack video recently on our YouTube channel. I think I released it today, and it was from Dominaria, and it was your swamp from Dominaria was in the pack. We talk about the artwork and all this kind of thing. And I think a large section of the community actually saw that your swamp from Dominaria was meant to be a crashed version of the Predator skyship from the old series. And you said to me, well, actually, it's more of a generic ruin. But I think those structures, like, it's not necessarily bad that people thought it was the Predator, and it wasn't necessarily like, oh, well, you know, it's not the Predator, so you shouldn't think that. It's just that those Phyrexian influences and the way that you had it crashed in the ground, much like when in Alien they first go up to the space jockeys, and it's this giant structure with all these kind of, you know, different elements to it. I think that explains a lot about how you treat influences and sort of callbacks in magic.
Yeah, that was a fantastic shot. I think movies like Alien do something really well, which is something that I've tried to emulate in my work. And you know, there's certain directors of photography that I really enjoy looking at their work. It's because when they approach the ship, there's this unmistakable eerie feeling that you are there with them. It gets really difficult to peel your eyes away from the screen. It's clearly not a friendly setting, right? It's incredibly hostile, but it's not overtly hostile. There's these, you know, these notes layered in there. And anytime I try to paint any piece, whether it's a bright plains or moody swamp, I think it's very important that I try my very best to capture that feeling of being there, right? What does it smell like? Mm-hmm. Is there wind? Is there no wind? And all these things kind of help set the scene, you know?
You create crazy atmosphere in your pieces. It's one of the reasons why I like the fact you do lands, because some lands can feel very flat regardless of how panoramic or wide the frame is, whereas in things like, say, like the Frontier Bivouac, like, you can feel the cold, you feel like you need to get under there. So yeah, it's good that comes through massively.
I think it's also interesting that you say that they're not necessarily being sort of in danger or being like, it's not a dangerous situation necessarily when they're walking up to the structure in Alien, because I had that same feeling when I was looking at your Phyrexian land for Jumpstart, because there's the Obliterator and the Vault Whispers, but it was all the way that when I first saw that artwork, I kind of thought that the Phyrexian Obliterator was almost melancholic, because it seemed almost up.
It's a Tuesday. He's just chilling out, you know.
Because not only is it a ruined structure, and it's the ruin of what was quite a glorious structure in a previous artwork, but the land around it is more putrid and acrid, even for Phyrexia. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seemed almost like it was, the Phyrexian itself was almost in a state of rotting away and being sort of melancholic and like glory of days gone by. Like, I have no idea if that's what you intended, but that's what I took from it.
Yeah, I can wax poetically a long time about that piece, no problem. But I think the original, just to keep it short, the original intent was to have the Obliterator, and this was the brief as well, an endless sea of oil. And I tried that out, and it was really cool. It was really striking. You feel like the Obliterator was almost statuesque, and that your presence went unnoticed until you move and ripple the oil, right?
Sure.
So, and we had to layer in a little bit of a background. So I thought the Vault of Whispers was kind of a cool shout out, and, you know, pieces kind of evolve and grow, but that part of the piece remained. And I think that kind of approach is always, is always really big in my work. Like, how does it feel? What's the like tagline for this stuff? And with the swamp, it was really all about, has the obliterator seen you already? They stand there in their own statuesque way. And if you know the card, you know what kind of carnage it can unleash. And if you know the Phyrexians, you know what kind of carnage they can unleash. But they haven't yet. They're just standing there still. And you are still. You're standing there looking at the card. And both of you are not interacting. And it's up to one of you to make that first move. Right. And that's kind of like hanging in that very precarious balance. Because what's that swamp going to be used for? What are you going to cast with that?
Yeah, you sure you want to tap that?
Do you want to force me to tap that mana? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this kind of approach to your work then just sort of definitely sounds like if you were to talk to someone who didn't know anything about like what goes into making magic art, or didn't even necessarily know about a lot of the flavor side of the game, it might seem a bit overblown and a bit much when talking about art in this way for something that is effectively a card game that is pitched at teens to, you know, sort of middle-aged people kind of play. But magic art, as we've sort of discussed, is hitting a peak of interest in people getting involved in it. But does it stand on its own? Like, I know this is something that you wanted to talk about, where how do you define art and fantasy art, and also art that's used in games for a commercial process? Can you divorce it from the fact that it's going to be on a bit of cardboard, or is that always there hanging over the piece of artwork that you do?
Yeah, that's the interesting question, isn't it? I think that's up for many people to decide for themselves. I think from a liberal arts point of view, anything that is done for commercial purposes cannot be art. That's kind of like the old view, right? If you use this for X product, it cannot be art. But this is a quite antiquated view, right? The most famous example is Andy Warhol with the Campbell soup, where he just paints a literal product, which then became art. So the question always goes, you know, I think it goes beyond that. And to be in the position to ask that question is already quite privileged. You have to know quite a bit about art. You have to be quite engaged with it. So the more we can get closer to the community having to have that discussion, the better it is for the art side, because you got some absolutely incredible painters working on the game, which make absolutely incredibly complicated and captivating pieces of art. And to say that they are purely bound to the product and unable to be divorced from that would be a huge demerit to the pieces themselves, right? So yeah, I think it's an important discussion to have.
I mean, it's interesting how you kind of approach that, and how the kind of classic ideas are kind of fading away, because I guess you can't necessarily get around the fact that if you're an artist just painting something for that romantic idea of you're painting or creating because it's your passion to do so and you've been inspired by some great muse, there's no other voices in your head telling you what to do or how to do it. But if you're working on a game like Magic the Gathering, because that's what we're talking about, you have your art director and then you have your sales team and your like everyone going all the way up the chain. But the decisions do, like, you are still the person with your hand on the paintbrush or on the stylus or whatever, however you're doing it. And your example for you using the Phyrexian Obliteracer and the Vault Whispers, to keep going back to that land, those were things that you input into your style. So where does the agency start and stop? Like,
yeah,
we've heard a lot about art directors from other artists that we've spoken to and everything, and the art directors seem to have a quite a big hand in how a whole set plays out. But like, does that cripple and stifle you, or do you use that as a tool for your work?
No, I think it depends on the piece, right? Because you're right, at the start of the day, not even at the end of the day, at the start of the day, it's a job. And you do it and you take the job because you need money to live. So I think that's your baseline. And Jesper Eising wrote about this in a recent blog post over on Muddy Colors, which is a great resource for any artist, that little bit of agency, as you say, can really push an artwork from being good to great. And not every piece has this opportunity. Sometimes a brief is not good. Sometimes you really don't enjoy painting a piece, but you have to enjoy it. It's work. But every so often you encounter a piece which really resonates with you. And I think then it becomes very, very important to kind of take a minute and figure out, okay, how far does this brief allow me to go? Because we have style guides and everything kind of needs to look the same. But every so often you can go like, okay, you know what? I'm going to try my own thing and I'm going to run with this a little bit and I'm going to really put my own spin on it. And usually, you tell your art director, you know, like I'm trying a different thing, but they're often quite open to having that extra bit because they know that if you really connect with that piece on multiple levels, it will be that much better. And there's this hidden, my art teacher used to do this trick where, you know, we'd have to put straight lines down on a piece of paper, just with a pencil, straight lines. And then he'd put a straight line down. And for some reason, their straight line looked infinitely better than ours. And it's impossible to put into words why that is, because they're both straight lines, but almost anybody could see that the one was slightly more pleasing to look at than the other. And I think that everybody has this ability to see that. And I think every so often we as artists, we can put that extra bit in there and then it shows, right? Then it's this unique quality.
Sure. I mean, what about how a piece of artwork is presented then in a vacuum? So, because the artwork that we see when we talk about magic, unless you're as invested as, say, someone like myself and Nathan are from what is essentially still a fan's perspective. Like, we do a podcast, but we're fans first and players first, where we will still look up like art galleries and we'll go on Scryfall and we'll search for a certain artist's name or whatever else. But we essentially still consume the art on that, you know, 4-inch by 6-inch bit of cardboard or however big Magic card is. What if you took that artwork out of its cardboard frame and if you just put it in like a gallery or if you just put it in an art show just as its own fantasy piece, does that commercial aspect of that artwork and that kind of, you know, sort of artwork by committee because it needs to sell a game aspect fall away? Can it be appreciated for its own thing, or do you think it's kind of still there?
That's interesting. I think that kind of reverses it. I feel like the commercial side of it is the fact that it sits on a card and is being used for another purpose. You know, if there wasn't an artwork on a swamp, the swamp still does the thing that the swamp does. I think, especially now that a lot of people want to chase up prints and originals and things like that, if anything, now the art is it's being able to lift itself out of the cards. It's now being, you know, put onto a canvas. It's now being hung up and framed. I think, if anything, it's, as much as it might be more, you know, quote unquote, commercially available to buy and everything, if anything, it's being hung as art more than, say, if it's being sat in a sleeve in your deck box.
I know that the Ron Spencer doubling season, I don't actually know how much it sold for in the end, but when I last peeked in halfway through its bidding process, it was sat at 12 grand. So there is a market for it. And that's not unusual. Like, and even sort of, and that might be attributed to the fact that it's doubling season. And that might be attributed to the fact that Magic fans who have the money to spend on artwork know it's Ron Spencer and know it's doubling season. But there are pieces by newer artists for Magic anyway, like Wiley Beckett, that are selling for thousands as well. And I just wonder, I mean, this is the question that kind of you've sparked the inspiration into me, Titus, is that I just wonder how you can make Magic art just art, and can you divorce it from the text box beneath it? I don't know what you
think. Well, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? It depends on who you ask. There's, again, lots of things to consider. Like, you could argue, is Ron Spencer's doubling season a better or worse illustration than Chris Ron's Ugin, which sold for more than 30,000? You know, by the price number, you can go like, oh, yeah, no, Ugin is clearly the better illustration, because that's normally how people look at it. And I think it was one of the angels that Tyler Jacobson had done, I can't remember it, but it's a veiled angel holding a sword at night. It's an absolutely wonderful illustration, and it won several awards. It won the Spectrum Gold Award, which is quite a big thing for artists. But then if you would ask an art critic if a contemporary painting that's figurative of an angel could ever make it into a gallery, you'd probably be laughed out, right? But if a contemporary landscape that was slightly more impressionistic, then they go like, yeah, that's maybe more acceptable. So it really becomes about who you ask and what the piece is for. Because liberal art, from a sales point of view, Magic is already achieving. Because, you know, you see some fine artists sell paintings for $1,500 or $2,000. And some Magic pencil sketches fetch more than that. You know, and we're talking about pieces that are in actual galleries. So would that pencil sketch ever be in a gallery? Like, no. From a liberal art point of view, from a fine art point of view, sales figure, is it successful? Absolutely. So it's a very difficult question, but I think the most important part is that more and more people start to talk about, and I don't think people understand the power that they have as consumers to, in labeling what art is. Because if you talk about the absolute creme de la creme, that's a really great way, you know, of like laundering money or tax evasion or whatever why they bid millions for it. They have their own reasons. But if you go one tier below that, you know, with the plein air painters, the still life painters, the portrait painters, I think then magic art comes really close.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. I think it's something about the game as well, being able to have ownership over something that you have a personal affinity to is really alluring. Mm. Sometimes I think you go into a gallery and it feels like the piece is meant to be, you know, looked at. It's not necessarily something that you engage with necessarily as much. And
yeah,
I guess it's tough as well, because obviously magic, we've talked about this before as well, this idea of the target of magic art tends not to be too abstract, too surrealist. It is becoming more and more focused. Right. And yes, okay, there is still variation in style and everything, but there is, yeah, as you say, a certain focus that might not be considered particularly daring or pushing new boundaries, or maybe the subject matter might be considered immature. I guess all of these are literally, unfortunately, subjective things. But yeah, it's funny because, as you say, like fantasy artwork, I mean, I don't think illustrations in a book for, like, say, something like The Silmarillion or anything is any less, you know, important. But obviously it is tied to the story. So I think magic artwork maybe has more opportunity to be separated, because it's not, I mean, it is a character, yeah, a specific person in a specific time and a specific plane. But obviously that person's had, as you say, the agency to kind of do what they want with it. And as you say, as soon as you start putting your life and your life into it, then it kind of, I feel like it's not just owned by WotC, it's kind of owned by the artists in the community as much, if not more.
Exactly. And it starts to lead its own life.
Yeah, that commercialism aspect really fucked me when you said that to begin with. I'm like, oh, if you buy it, it's not art. Well, that just screws up everything about creativity.
But, I mean, do you know, like, it's an interesting one. What merits, like, how do you even define what art is? How do you define art is a stupid question, but how do you define art, like, as a commercial thing? Because I'm a big fan of Mark Rothko. Like, he's one of my favorite artists, just to pull an artist that I like. And he had an exhibition in the Tate Modern in London a few years ago, and I went to see his paintings, and I went to see his monoliths. And I engaged with that art because I went there and I sort of soaked it in, and I engaged with the art as you do in an art gallery. But it didn't go any further than that. And I sat in the room for 45 minutes and then I left, and I kind of satisfied my own curiosity into an artist that I liked from seeing his work in a digital format. I saw them in analog, if you like. But when you're playing magic, and if you're interested in the art, and if it is something that just at a baseline excites you, and you have your playmat and you have your sleeves that you like, and you have other people's artwork that they really enjoy, you're engaging with that artwork far more than I engaged with Mark Rothko's artworks when they were hung up in the Tate, or I went to the Sistine Chapel and I engaged with that. But it, you know, I got shuffled through at a rate of knots, and I didn't see it. I didn't soak it in, but I bought that playmat for a reason. You know, Seb McKinnon's Kickstarters and Janusz Voss's Kickstarters make a lot of money for a reason. And does that make magic art and fantasy art for games? I mean, in a sense, that makes them more successful in some metrics. It depends how you kind of value it, right?
It depends if you're a cynic or not, right? Because if you're a cynic, you say it's no different than you know, any old slogan on a t-shirt that just happens to be successful, because you're approaching it from a very kind of cynical or snobby point of view. I think if you get to that point, it doesn't matter if you classify something as art or not. If you create something to be enjoyed by people, and it is in fact enjoyed by people, you have already transcended what it's supposed to do, because the only thing that it's supposed to do technically is accompany the mechanic that is on the card. And the second that it goes beyond that, because people engage with it, you know, they cosplay it or they buy a print of it, you've already gone beyond the scope of what it was originally intended to do. And I think that for any piece of media is incredibly difficult.
Sure. Do you feel as an artist, this is a big question, this might be on the spot a bit, do you feel as an artist who that does illustrations for card games and for D&D, that you've reached a level where your art is enjoyed? Do you feel that as someone who produces this work, or is that something a bit too unattainable for you, or like abstract to think about?
Yeah, it's, yeah, That's difficult because
like don't let your ego get in the way of this. If you want to say fuck yes, I've hit the like gold mine, then go for it, because I mean people love your art, man. Like, you know, your Phyrexian Swamp made people go nuts, and that's just the latest in a long line of illustrations where people have really engaged with it. Like, but do you feel that sat in your studio, or is that something which is other and divorced, you know?
No, for me, no. I think I'd love to be at the point where I could, you know, legit say, fuck yeah, people like my art, and I know that they like my art and really feel it, right? And now I know that people enjoy my art because, you know, I'm here talking to you guys, and so I go like, yeah, no, on some level I do know, but it's really difficult. Artists are on the whole, not to generalize too much, but artists on the whole are kind of strange people.
Sure. Yeah.
No, we're not.
We tend to have.
Well, I mean, myself and Nathan have a theatre background, so I think yeah, we can appreciate nice, that. Yeah.
Well, you know, once I start to talk about anxiety and that kind of stuff, you know, it'll sound very familiar. And imposter syndrome, and
you never want to get comfortable, you know, either, because otherwise you stop kind of pushing yourself. You get complacent.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a tough. Yeah.
I think that's something that you fear. No, but you're aware that people like your stuff. You obviously, when you get a reprint card, you go like, shit, now I have to. Every time you get a reprint, it will be either loved more or hated more than anything you've done up to that point. Sure. So you're keenly aware of that. So I think it's, in a way, you have to divorce yourself from that in order to be able to perform and consider it. This is just a job. Because I think anytime you get a brief, it needs to start out as just a job, and you make that in a void where nobody will ever have an opinion on it that, you know, will reach you. But sometimes it crosses over, right? Again, when we're talking about that piece of agency, when we have pieces that have a chance to become a little bit more, then you start to think about that stuff, right? And then the pride comes in and it creates a completely different piece. Like, for example, Crop Sigil and Terrarion were painted in the same week.
Really? Yet,
Crop Sigil has a really different feel. I was struggling with the piece. I didn't really enjoy it that much. Whereas Terrarion, I thought, yeah, this is cool. It's a reprint as well. But I like the card. This brief really, you know, is up my alley. And I think for me, when I look at those illustrations, one holds up to this day and the other really does not. So yeah.
Because one's an artifact and one's an enchantment.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Just say. But I do what you mean. I do what you mean. So yeah, I can kind of I see what you mean. There is a bit more. I don't want to say life. I mean, don't get me wrong. Innistrad's dying anyway. It's a dying plane. So I guess I can understand. But yeah, there are two very, very different things you're doing. Obviously, one's a landscape. Like enchantments in general seem to be the most difficult kind of things to nail down artistically. Like I think the biggest one for me was the circle, the enchantment circle. You know what I mean, Andy? The one, the night one from Eldraine. Yeah, it doesn't feel like what it is. And artifacts are quite easy to, you know, it's a bit of artifice. It's kind of fine and easy. How do you make an enchantment, you know, that's scorched, you know? I think the way you've done it, like scorching the land, is fantastic. But yeah, it's a very difficult thing to maybe...
It's tough.
...find affinity with.
It's abstract magic. Like, and also, how do you even describe that? Like, when I describe sort of like a wizard or a sorcerer and they're using magic, I describe it as their aura. But like, how does that, what does that mean? Like, you know, yeah, it's very tough.
I also think maybe this is where you hit the nail on the head. Because I was looking through your art station earlier, and some of the artworks that really pop out to me are ones that would never work as magic cards. Not just because you do a lot of sci-fi work that I really enjoy, but obviously fantasy and sci-fi are quite different. But I guess subject matter is really important. Like, obviously with most magic cards, unless it is like an enchantment or a land, you do have that subject. And if most and good arts, I mean, don't get me wrong, still life is a lauded type of artwork, but I mean realistically, any, you know, landscapes and things like that are more highly praised. And it might be difficult when your, you know, subject is a dragon or a goblin smacking another goblin over the head, or this little trinket. It's kind of hard to make it feel not twee. It's a really hard word. I want to find what the word is for magic artwork, because it has a very specific word, and I don't know what it is. Doing these interviews, we're getting closer and closer, but it does have a certain feeling to it that does, yeah, divorce it ever so slightly from being individualistic and artwork, and obviously being a point of a subject that you kind of have to, yeah, to build the entire piece around. And then think enchantments, maybe where that line just kind of falls apart completely.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing that you say, because it hits the crossover of the kind of two archetypes of artists, at least that I know of, where the one artist is kind of like, you know, they're so connected with the story. You know, when they're painting goblins, they go like, oh, I like him. This goblin, this is his name, and this is the other goblin's name. And they kind of smack it. They're the little kid who had, you know, the little toy figurines that were really animatedly painted or animatedly fighting with them, and go like, and they can really empathize with the characters that they're painting. They have stories for it, and they're interested in their backstories and all that kind of stuff, right? Whereas I can't do that. If somebody gave me like, oh, paint this human with a sword, it would never go beyond human with sword, because that's not what I, it's not what I care about. It's not what I find interesting. I find their setting interesting, and where are they, and when is that? Yeah, exactly. And enchantments cross over, because you need to have the clear environment, but then also a bit of narrative from the character point of view, which makes them quite, on the whole, quite difficult. They can be quite difficult.
It's almost like a passive action, and that's a really, how do you draw a passive action?
Oh yeah, same for any 2 point or 2 or 3 frame animation kind of thing. They're a nightmare.
So we're talking about, you know, different styles of painting, and how you talk about artists have a lot of anxiety and a lot of sort of imposter syndrome and stuff. Like, how, I mean, the magic community, artist wise, there's loads of artists that work on magic, but a lot of you guys seem to be quite on like a one-to-one basis, because I'm sure you must sort of like work with each other quite a bit in certain capacities. Like, are there any artists that you like really admire at the moment in magic, or are there any artists where you kind of really dig their stuff? Like, who are the kind of artists that you really are into at the moment in magic?
Well, I have my usual suspects. I guess I'm friends with Tyler Jacobson and Chris Ron, because they're, and this is something that I think most people wouldn't really notice, but from a technical point of view, the way that they control, and Johannes Voss does this too, and the way that they control their values in art is incredible. It's incredibly difficult to control it the way that they do. So yeah, they're always kind of high. John Avon is always up there, not because his technique is that good, but he has a way of creating very striking images with very little tools. And that too is really difficult, not because some of the more modern artwork tends to get very, very complex and very complicated, because with the digital tools, we can 3D model stuff and, you know, reiterate on it and over, and pieces tend to get extremely complicated, which doesn't always help. So I tend to come back to the same ones, and I feel bad because I'm probably forgetting like a dozen artists, like Chase Stone, for example. Chase Stone, he's like the most method artist that I know, right? He's like a method actor. He prepares for pieces for a very long time. And weirdly enough, with Chase Stone, you guys don't get to see this, I guess, but his sketches, I don't know if he ever posts it. He's kind of a social recluse on the internet. But his sketches are often far better than his finals, in my opinion, because while his finals are super tight and sometimes with 3D elements, I've seen him just paint that way in a matter of, you know, an hour, and it's mind boggling. So yeah,
I guess if you immerse yourself into it, you can kind of, it flows maybe a little easier, and then when you have to when you finally have to clip it, it kind of loses that extra bit of potential that was still going.
I guess maybe you feel like, because it is going back to a little bit of our earlier conversation, you feel that because it is going to be a product that is going to help a company sell a game, you might need to polish it a bit more. I know that your partner, Suzanne Helmig, I've completely butchered her name, I'm sorry.
Oh,
thank you very much. There we go. Cross it. UK. I'm an Englishman that can say different names. There we go. I know that they've done, they're actually a little bit different to your art style. I mean, obviously they would be, but where you talk about how you find characters very different. Susan does lots of figures. I know Outlaw's Merriment and all the tokens surrounding it.
Yeah.
Like, is there anything, I don't know how, like, whether you guys work sort of in close proximity to each other, but is there any like looking over the shoulder being like, how are you doing that? And I'm
she's sitting right behind me now. No, we get asked the question a lot if we work together or if we kind of like feedback on each other's work or how does that work? And I think while we do sometimes do commissions together, we did a DM screen for Beetling Grimm's Eberron for D&D together. But we have a completely different philosophy in how we approach art and what we find important. And I think in terms of being a landscape or a character oriented character story or landscape mood, we couldn't be further apart on the spectrum where we come from. Right. So it's kind of weird because I see why people would ask how, you know, if we work together and how we work together, but we come from such a different, it's like you're both builders, right? Mm. But one is a mason and the other is a roofer. Like, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you work together, but you don't work together, right?
Sure.
Yeah, you complement.
You understand you understand the process that you're going through. And I think mostly from a support point of view, it's the best because we have quite big ups and downs. And, you know, art is not an easy profession. Same for, I guess, theater. You know, it's not easy to do that kind of stuff. So having a partner that understands that is incredibly valuable.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, one of the sort of things that we've been asking artists and different creatives that we've had on the show, and I didn't put this in the brief, so if you think, oh, it's a bit of a tough question, then we'll sideskirt it a little bit. But was there...
Exactly, yeah. Take it easy so far.
I have a habit of doing this. I'll look at my outline and I'll go, oh, that's all trash. I'll just ask him this instead. Was there a point in your work in magic, or really anywhere else, but because we're a magic podcast, we tend to relate it back to that. Was there any like level up moment for you in your work? Was there a specific artwork, or maybe your work during a certain set, where you think you discovered something new, or maybe you moved in a different way that you're really sort of happy about? Or has it been consistently knocking it out of the fucking park ever since you started?
I mean, it feels like it's the opposite, right? No, I mean, I had there's this distinct like light bulb memory, right, where I went to the States for a push, and I was so jet lagged, and I kind of rushed through my battle bond lands, and I missed the deadline by 2 weeks, I thought, but it was actually 2 weeks early, so. Those pieces have such a loose feel because I really rushed through them, right? trying to get them right. And as I was doing those pieces, I was jet lagged. I was working, you know, coming into the office at 8 a.m. and then leaving at 6 and then doing the battle bond things. And it was right at the point as well where I was really bummed that coming from a concept background, it's about making super realistic images fast. So as a concept artist for video games, you need to make 2 or 3 hyper-realistic pieces per day. So you use a lot of photo work and et cetera. And I was trying to move away from that, but I was trying to reconcile how I could get photorealistic looking work, but actually painted all by hand. And how'd you do that? And I was talking to Tyler and Chris that I mentioned earlier, and they introduced me to shadow shapes, which is a thing that you do a lot in portrait art, where you just paint the shadows of a figure, right? If you break down an image into 3 tones, you have your highlights where the light hits, you have your midtones, and then you have your shadows. You can actually build an image entirely using only shadow.
Yeah, you've got on your art station, haven't you, with the triples, right. And studies and dirtles. I was looking at this earlier. And on the bottom, on the middle one, it's literally just 3 colors of, well, not yellow, but you've got the yellow, you've got the darker ochre, and then you've got the black. And yeah, all you need is the 3, and you've got the cheekbones, you've got the, it's really clever.
Yeah. So, and that just opened up, like, I was like, oh shit. Yeah. And it made me realize that the form in my other paintings was terrible, but the paintings that followed that were good. And I think shortly after I painted Temple of Malady and Mystic Forge, which I think to date may still be one of the best illustrations that I've done.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's weird because their conversations, my jet lag, the rushed pieces were still all so fresh. And then clearly Temple of Malady and Mystic Forge are way more rendered than the Battle Bond lens. They're way more tight, right? They're zoomed in. But since that was all still very fresh, it was like, okay, this is clearly a level of moment. And it's one of those things where you capture lightning in a bottle and you try to do that afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it the detail? Was it the lighting? Was it, you know?
Yeah, that's what you said. Was it
the jet lag?
Exactly. Was it the jet lag? Yeah. I've got to take a flight every time I do a painting now. Yeah. It's like, because it was your forest was the last land I had that made me had to take a second look back. because I was playing against someone who's playing an elf deck, and he only had these lands as his lands. And because I didn't play a lot of Battle Bonds, I didn't pay too much attention to them. But yeah, these were the ones I was. I'm surprised you say that, because I find them really. I like the rough kind of aspect to them. The lack of the definition thing kind of almost gives them more freedom, you know, more expression. So yeah, I'm glad you didn't get a chance to finish them properly.
Well, what's interesting about these ones as well is that they're all from a very similar view, and a lot of your lands tend to be you're still at a low angle looking up, or you're either that or you're a very high looking over, like a landscape. Mm. These ones still have that aspect to them, but they're all quite balanced across the frame, where I know a lot of your lands, like your Temple of Malady, for example, is at kind of a Dutch angle, and I know your like your Orzhov Guildgate is kind of off to the side, and same with some of your...
Towering over you, perspective.
Yeah,
these are a bit way more face-on.
Yeah, I like them. They're very, very cool. Well, that's really cool to know. So you need to... that's it, Nathan. If we need to improve our content creation, we just need to hop on a flight and get incredibly tired. And just rush around.
Well, I think you know what it was. I think, like, looking back on all of those pieces, and any piece which I still think holds up, is because either I was so tired, literally, or I was so tired of being anxious or filled with imposter syndrome that there's this, you know, this second wave of confidence. And it's not, I don't think either it's confidence or just fatigue blocking out any negative emotion that you can, but then you're much more in the flow.
Yeah. Well, we don't have a huge amount of time left, but the last little thing I want to kind of talk to you about, and again, it's similar to where your level up moment is and the artist that you inspire. It's in that kind of realm of questions. And that's, in regards to Magic and D&D, but also in regards to larger fantasy artwork that's maybe related to games and IPs, where do you want to see the artwork going? Like, do you think the trajectory is all there and it's just more of the same? You just want art to be pushed more to the forefront? Or do you think there needs to be a change in attitude towards fantasy art? Like, where do you want it to go?
Another easy one.
Another easy one.
Yeah, that is a good question. I have to think about that one for a second.
Because I know just with general in the world recently, there's been lots of call to hold companies, for example, to a higher standard when it comes to accessibility or it comes to like just how they treat their workers and treat the general public. But also that's been kind of put onto the magic art world recently, where people want to have like their artists held to a higher standard or their treatment of workers to a higher standard. Do you think it lies in that, like the actual production of the work, or do you think the visual style is something which needs to be pushed more? Like, what do you think needs like a new ratchet?
I think, so coming back to a bit of magic history, one of my good friend, Richard Witters, he is a, he's now the main art director for the Dungeons & Dragons brand. Mm-hmm. But he started out with Jeremy Jarvis as a concept artist for Magic the Gathering. And this was a long time ago. And when they came in, this was in 2006, 2007, I think. Magic was on a little bit of a decline. It was struggling, right? Mm-hmm. It was super popular at the late 90s. Then it got managed a lot. Right. We have to push for this to be and that to be. So it was struggling a little bit. And struggling to the point where in come these two dudes and they ask him, please just create some planes for us. And, you know, here's a carte blanche. Just do, you know, because who still gives a shit about this game, right? Mm. And they come up with Innistrad, Zendikar, and Mirrodin, arguably in the top five of most iconic magic planes ever.
Sure.
And it was because they weren't oversighted that much. People didn't care that much, and their own voices came out a lot more. And I think we need to go back to that, but on a much broader scale. Mm-hmm. I think, and WotC to a certain degree is very much aware of this, their style guides and their world building had gotten extremely specific, which kind of takes the fun out of us as artists, but you, from a commercial point of view, you can understand. But now they're looking at the broader spectrum, and I think we need much more diversity in the artist space that we have by far, and part of the responsibility there is within the artist community to make it, you know, friendlier. Then I think the company needs to hire more diverse people. And then I think they need to focus less on the exact nitpicky part and stop over art directing stuff, which is not their fault. It's, you know, it's what everybody top down wants. And this is the horrible part as an illustrator where you have to illustrate by committee, where you and the art director might be on the same page, but somebody else wants something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I think if we do that, we start to appeal to a more broad group of people. And I think like the alternate art stuff that we'd seen in Ikoria, right? The alternate lands and the Godzilla stuff.
Secret
lands.
I think that was, well,
exactly. I think some of that is a little bit too heavy handed and on the nose.
Would you say maybe the lands for someone like Jumpstart is maybe where they're trying out these kinds of things, where it's not overt, but it's something slightly different.
Well, it depends on the artist as well. So some artists just do have that heavy-handed touch, and it feels kind of off if you're not used to it, right? So I think it's trying to find what matches, but at least introducing people to the fact that we have in the art world, in the contemporary art world, an incredibly diverse group. And if we can tap into that and find the right place in showing that, I think that could be incredibly a positive, because what it allows everybody to do is that, okay, now you're taking kind of the pressure off and how this is supposed to look. Like, it no longer needs to fit this picture perfect, you know, Hollywood bleached teeth kind of whatever boring shit that it could move into. If you continue down this road, all the art will look extremely homogenous. And some games already do this, and I think it's terrible. I think it's awful. And the fact that a lot of teenagers like it, I don't care.
Because teenagers don't know what they like. They don't, the world is telling them the wrong things, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, right. What do they know? And I think if you go like, okay, we have this really high standard for artwork because we have art directors and senior management who understand the difference between good art and bad art, regardless of how it's painted, right? And what kind of style or genre it's painted. If you have confidence in those people, and you give them a little bit of free rein, they will hire people who will then feel free to do whatever it is that they want to do, right? Because, for example, I want to work less rendered, less tight. Yeah. But that's not what they hired me for. And I have this discussion with them all the time. And they said, no, we like the tight stuff that you do. That's the slot that you fill. So please keep doing that. And I'm like, okay, then I'll treat it as a job, right? Then which is fine. We have this relationship. But now you're noticing that from my side and their side, they're kind of go like, okay, well, actually, when we let the reins loose a little bit, you feel more comfortable and you create better work because you feel more connected to it. And I was like, yeah, exactly. So I think if we could move there with everyone, with a much more diverse crowd and not just white dudes.
They should have confidence really in good people as well. Like, at the end of the day, over the years, but this game's been running long enough now. And it's funny that a combination of both artists being more in the spotlight and obviously diversity being more in the spotlight is the perfect time for them to capitalize on it and lead the wave. Even if it is conceited from a business point of view, you know, they're just satisfying the masses and ticking the boxes. At least they're ticking the boxes, even if it is a contrived way of doing so. So if you have confidence in your team, then your team is going to do amazing things for you. You've just got to, you know, as you say, let the reins off a little.
Yeah, and you could tick the boxes and have significant progress from almost a societal point of view at the same time, right? If we could advance tolerance through capitalism, all right, you know, fuck it, let's do that first.
Let's just do it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because then we'll at least have the one thing, so, and then we can see afterwards, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Let's see if we can move more towards liberal
Yeah,
cool. Well, I think that's a pretty good message to end on, to be honest with you. Let's all use Magic the Gathering artwork to bust the system wide open. I think that's probably a good way to think about it.
I agree.
Cool. Well, like, Titus, mate, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us. It's been an absolute blast. We love recording interview sessions with people, but it's a real treat to sort of see inside your mind and to kind of hear your thoughts on things that sometimes we don't really get to hear about. Like, a lot of people, they only engage with artists through just what they see on the cardboard, and even if they like you through virtue of that. Like, it's much cooler to kind of actually hear and see you and, you know, have you as a person on chatting about magic. Yeah. It's really cool.
Having one foot in, one foot out really helps a lot.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. If they want to sort of see more of your work outside of the cardboard, or if they want to kind of catch you out in the wide world, well, I say the wide world, online, they probably shouldn't approach you in the street. Where can people find you online?
Well, it's just my name, Titus Lunter, on Twitter and my main website, tituslunter.com.
Cool, fantastic. Guys, if you want to hit us up on Twitter, or indeed in the wide world, you can find us on Twitter at mtflavoring. Emails go to mtflavoring@gmail.com. My personal Twitter is at Andy Manface. Nathan's, yours is?
At the Fox in the Moon.
At the Fox in the Moon. If you haven't checked out our YouTube channel yet, it is very creatively called Magic the Flavoring on YouTube, where you can find us doing lots of different videos. This will also probably pop up there as well, so you can see it in visual form with all bright lights and colours. Other than that, Nathan, do you have any final thoughts for this episode?
No, I'm hot as balls. My windows are closed. Can I please go and open them now, please, Andy?
Yeah, we can let you off and you can go open your windows. All right, well, guys, other than that, as ever, thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring.
We'll see you soon. Thank you.